5-4-3. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us this Sunday evening. Most people, when they think of covert operations or spying in terms of military, think of what's currently going on with our nation, and that perhaps things going on in the Middle East or even the events that took place during World War II. But would you believe that back during the Civil War under the Lincoln administration, this nation did, at least the both the Confederates and the Union armies, did have spies and people who went back to their camps, went back to their leadership, informing them of troop movements or anything that was important to winning the war. And a new book came across my desk recently, Lincoln Spies, Their Secret to Save a Nation, The War to Save a Nation. And the author is Doug Waller. He joins me this evening. And we'll be talking for the next half hour about those particular spies who were entrusted with information going back to President Lincoln in hopes of winning the war. Doug, nice to have you with us.
It's good to be with you.
Doug, I never, you know, in my wildest imagination, as I said at the outset, you know, right now, obviously, what was going on in the Middle East and wherever we have combat issues, terrorism that's going on. So people think, oh yeah, well we've got our intelligence community keeping an eye on things, keeping us safe. But I think most people would be astounded to think that even back in the 1860s, during the Civil War, predominantly, that there was the use of spies. Was that the first time that you're familiar with that this introduction of people going back to, in this case, President Lincoln or to the Confederacy? We're using spies in sending information to one camp or the other.
Well, no. Actual spying, cloak and dagger work has been going on for a long time in the U.S., all the way back to the Revolutionary War. What we saw different in the Civil War was there was a revolution in warfighting technology during this war. You had, for example, railroads that were able now to move men and supplies to the front far more quickly. You had telegraph, which was able to link battlefields, far distant battlefields, with headquarters commands or even with Washington with very quick communications. Photography came on board during this war. For example, you remember that Matthew Brady photographs of soldiers mm-hmm. posing stiffly. Well, there were also photographers that went out with the Union Army to covertly take shots of battlefields and places and Confederate encampments. The telegraph ushered in the whole issue of being able to tap into an enemy's lines and intercept his communication. So both sides developed fairly primitive codes when they used Morse code or even flag signals. This was the introduction of aerial reconnaissance. You know, the spy satellites you see today or the spy planes you see today can trace their origin back to hydrogen gas-filled balloons that the Union Army used. They went up about 1,000 feet with aeronauts dangling in wicker baskets below them and could, in order to scope out the battlefield and also direct artillery fire to the battlefield. So, you know, all what you found is a good bit of the intelligence collection work set in the Civil War set the template for what you see the CIA, the NSA, and other spy agencies doing today.
Before we get into the actual personalities that you cover in the book, let me ask you right up front, had it not been for the use of, as you said, this early stage reconnaissance, the spies that that you talk about in the book, would there have been a different outcome in terms of the Civil War?
The short answer is probably not. I mean, even if, for example, the Confederate Army had the best spy service of the two, better than the Union spy service, and exactly the opposite was the case, the outcome of the war would have remained the same. I mean, the bottom line is that the North had far, far more resources, men, arms, factories, and everything, and they basically just wore down the South. Now, did espionage, intelligence gathering contribute to the war? Absolutely. But as in most wars, World War II, World War I, intelligence gathering and espionage was not the deciding factors there, and it wasn't really in the Civil War. But it contributed in important ways.
You and I spoke a little bit before broadcast, and I mentioned to you that history, sort of a history buff, but more importantly, also biographies, and over the years I've read quite a bit of biographies on presidents. And I've come to really, obviously it was long before you or I, but Abraham Lincoln goes down, I think, in most people's eyes as perhaps one of the greatest presidents. But you've heard this coined term, Honest Abe. So let me ask you, was a man like Abraham Lincoln the type of person that was willing to go along with this? Was he comfortable, I guess is what I'm trying to say, with spies, a spy network providing information to the Union Army and to him directly?
Well, first off, it's interesting. Honest Abe was basically a term his campaign concocted for him for the election. Lincoln didn't even like the term Honest Abe. He preferred to be called Mr. Lincoln. He entered office one of the least prepared men in government service to be president. We only had one term in Congress and four terms in the Illinois state legislature. But he was hardly a neophyte when it came to subterfuge and intrigue. He practiced it in campaigns in Illinois. He was a regular collector of political intelligence during the presidential campaign. When he entered into office, one of the first things he did was have General Winfield Scott, who was the aging commander of the Army, submit daily to him intelligence reports on what the Army was picking up about the Confederate forces. He routinely interviewed or carved time out of his busy schedule to interview reporters who had been down south to give him a feel of what was going on there. He grilled Army officers who had been to the front to find out what was going on or to gather information. He wasn't shy about using covert operations. He approved a number of them for the South. He could also be ruthless when he had to be, suspending the writ of habeas corpus, closing down newspapers that contradicted or were hostile to administration war aims. So this was clearly a president who may have been a neophyte coming in, but he quickly adapted and knew how to use executive powers, particularly in the covert area.
In the book, you highlight four individuals specifically, and then I know there were other people because you talk about that, but these four people, Alan Pinkerton, Lafayette Baker, George Sharp, and Elizabeth Van Loo, and surprisingly, a woman. I was somewhat taken back because I thought, if Lincoln was going to entrust information going back and forth or make decisions based on information in that time period, women would not have been privy to it, but she certainly was. So we'll talk a little bit, but let me start with Alan Pinkerton. Why was he and these other three important to you?
They actually represented a good mix of characters for me to present the whole intelligence operation and give the reader kind of a full flavor of it. I've done ensemble biographies before. I did one before, and this one appealed to me. Basically, I had Alan Pinkerton, who was famous nationwide as a detective at the time. You had Lafayette Baker, who think of him kind of as Lincoln's J. Edgar Hoover, only a little more seamy. And he ran counterintelligence operations in Washington, also skimmed money off the top and pocketed it. You had George Sharp, who became eventually the Army of the Potomac's intelligence chief and was Grant's intelligence chief, a very erudite New York lawyer, fluent in French and Italian, had one of the best educations you could get at that time. And then you had Elizabeth Van Loo, who ran the Union spy ring in Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, an absolutely fearless woman and very, very resourceful down there.
Yeah, she stuck out more than anything, Doug, and not because she's a woman, but because, as you just said, she's in the midst of the Confederacy, for one. She took no, she didn't put up with anybody's shenanigans. If anybody said anything about what she was doing or questioned her in any way, shape, or form, if anybody tried to cut her down to size because she was a woman, I got the impression that she had quite a lot of moxie. But again, going back, and I want to focus a little bit on her in particular, why would the Union Army entrust her particularly?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There were actually a lot of women spies during the Civil War. It was basically a job outlet for women, something they could do for the war. I mean, they really had two job outlets during the war. They could be nurses in field hospitals in the front, or they could be spies. And, you know, the men of the time were very chauvinistic. They thought, how could a woman know military matters and, how could they possibly be of use? In fact, that was the view of Robert E. Lee. He didn't think much of women as espionage agents. But they turned out to be actually very good. First off, because nobody thought they could do it, so it was an instant cover for them. In Elizabeth Van Loo's case, she was a Virginia heiress, came from a very wealthy family, old-line Virginia family, so everybody thought, she couldn't possibly be an espionage agent or a spy. But she turned out to be very resourceful. Women could read newspapers. They could read, battlefield reports. They could, organize and get information out of their areas and send it to the other side. I mean, there were women espionage agents who ran spy operations against the Union. There was a very famous Confederate spy ring in Washington that Alan Pinkerton broke up, run by Rose O'Neill Greenhow. So Elizabeth Van Loo was unusual because she was a real workhorse. She organized a very efficient Union espionage ring in Richmond that Confederate agents were never able to crack. And they tried. They suspected her, but they were never able to prove anything on her.
The fact that these people were operating it sounds like they had they had the blessing of both President Lincoln and the Union armies. But let me ask you, how did they were they that good at infiltrating? I mean, did any Confederates pick up early on that, hey, Pinkerton, Baker, Sharp, and Van Loo, if you see these people, beware, capture them? Or did they go pretty much undetected and were able to just kind of come and go as they pleased and the whole time picking up vital information?
Well, first off, these were all amateurs at war. Mm. Okay, none of them had any espionage training. You know, there was no intelligence school back there, no Camp Perry like the CIA runs today,
right,
to train spies. These were people that just learned as they went, and they made mistakes. They had successes, but they also had failures. Alan Pinkerton sent agents into Richmond who were captured by the Confederates. One of them, Timothy Webster, who was a very resourceful agent for Alan Pinkerton, was captured and eventually hung in Richmond as a spy, so it could be dangerous work. They kind of learned as they went. Now, they had some advantages in this espionage field. Number one, they were each side was spying in territory where they knew the other side's language and culture. Okay, so it was easy, for example, for a northern spy to blend in the South. Basically, all he had to learn how to do was fake a southern accent, which wasn't all that hard to do. It made it easier for both sides to conduct espionage in many respects unnoticed. But they had to learn as they go. Pinkerton, for example, violated a lot of cardinal rules of spy masters. For example, he sent counter-espionage agents into Richmond to do intelligence work, which in the spy business is a no-no, mainly because counter-espionage agents expose themselves in their work and catch spies. And when they go into another enemy territory to conduct espionage, they can also often get identified by the other spy networks that have been working against him, which happened in Pinkerton's case.
It's at least from my viewpoint, if I were President Lincoln, or if I were president and I had people in the spy community and directly, reporting to me directly, or reporting to Union officers, Grant in particular, directly, I'd certainly want to make sure that I had their trust. Did Lincoln, did his, you know, did his commanders, his senior commanders, feel comfortable? Because you had talked about early that these people were not, you know, militarily trained. Most of them were amateurs coming into this, but, you know, very savvy in their own way. But was the Union Army, the leadership, and President Lincoln comfortable with information coming back to them?
The short answer is yes and no. First off, keep in mind, Lincoln started out with no espionage agency, no intelligence agency to speak of, certainly no centralized intelligence agency.
Right.
Each Union Army general was expected to set up his own spy network in his area, whether he was a division commander, corps commander, or a full army commander. And these were Union generals who had no intelligence training when they went to West Point. Lincoln, interestingly, he went and checked out books from the Library of Congress on military strategy and paced the floor of his bedroom at night reading them to learn how, you know, learn the art of war. He also educated himself on the art of intelligence gathering. And very often, Lincoln wasn't well served by his intelligence officers, particularly Alan Pinkerton, who routinely inflated the number count for Confederate troops. General George McClellan, who headed up the Army of the Potomac, the Union Army of the Potomac, was facing. And Lincoln eventually caught on to the fact that McClellan and Pinkerton were dialing up the Confederate numbers, using it as an excuse to demand more Union soldiers before they would fight. In fact, Lincoln had it was kind of an interesting anecdote on him that he once told a New England delegation that he knew the Confederate Army had 1 million men. And he said the reason he knew was because every time his Union generals lost a battle, they told him they faced 2-to-1 odds. And he knew he had 500,000 troops, and he joked, well, the Confederate Army must have 1 million. But it showed that he was skeptical very often of some of these intelligence reports that came in.
Yeah, amazing considering the time, and as you said, I mean, this was really coming of age. As you mentioned earlier, we did have spies going all the way back to the Revolutionary War, but it was still in its, in its early stages. I want to take a quick pause, let folks know that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Vona, your host. My guest this week is best-selling author Doug Waller. His new book, Lincoln Spies, Their Secret War to Save a Nation. And we're talking about during the war between the states, the use of counterintelligence and spies in aiding both, in this particular case, the Northern Armies and President Lincoln, but the use of spies on both sides. Doug, which leads me to the next question that you undetected. You spent a lot of time researching a lot of this information, and I'm sure some of it was probably eye-opening for you as well. Was there something going into this? I mean, I would think that as an author, you think, okay, what would be interesting, not only to me, but to readers? Why this idea of spies during the Civil War? Why was that enticing?
Well, first off, and I guess there's a little truth in advertising, I'm not a Civil War historian. Don't even play one on TV. I'm a journalist. I covered the CIA for Time magazine and also before that for Newsweek magazine. My previous two books were on espionage and intelligence collection during World War II. One of them was a biography of General William Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the Office of Strategic Services, which was Franklin Roosevelt's espionage agency. The other book was on four key aides who worked under Donovan in the OSS who later became CIA directors like Alan Dulles. For my next project, I wanted to do something again on espionage, but I decided to switch wars and go back to the Civil War. And I'm glad I did, because it was, as I say, it was an interesting, fresh, new subject for me. And I found these, fascinating how, you know, so much of the espionage in the Civil War set the template for what we see in espionage today. For example, I can remember going through the National Archives, and I spent months and months there going through microfilms and original Civil War documents. And I ran across one proposal that a Philadelphia inventor had sent to the Army. He proposed that you take one of these small hydrogen gas balloons, attach it to a camera, and send it aloft, and have a wire attached to it to a soldier on the ground who'd send up an electrical charge, and the camera would take a photo of the battlefield. And I kind of stopped at that, and I said, this is an aerial drone, you know, which, 150 years later, how many years later, we see operating over Iraq and Afghanistan. So this is really probably one of the first ideas of an aerial drone. Interestingly, the Union officer who was reviewing the project rejected it because he couldn't see how the balloon could keep the camera steady up there to take a clear photo, which was probably the case back then.
Right.
But we can actually see where the origin of drones went all the way back to the Civil War.
Yeah, I was impressed by that too, because I'm thinking to myself just to what you were talking about. This is the beginning of the drone,
yeah.
You know, and yet here it is back in 1860s. Obviously it was tried and true. Some things worked out, mm-hmm. Some things didn't, which leads me to the next question. And that being, what was most effective? Was it actual people infiltrating, Union spies infiltrating Confederacy and vice versa? Was it the use of telegraph? I know you mentioned the balloons, but because it was so early on and the unsteadiness and probably the lack of clarity in some of those photographs. So what part of spying was really most effective?
It was probably, in some cases, the human collection and the analysis of the human collection. So, for example, tapping telegraph lines and intercepting flag signals worked only to a degree, and there was only so much information they could get out. The Confederates were never really able to break the Union codes that they used to send information over the telegraph line or wigwag it with flags at the top, on the top of mountains. The Union was able to break the Confederate code mainly because the Confederates didn't use it properly, and it was easy to break. In terms of aerial surveillance, it had a fairly good effect on intelligence gathering, or was useful intelligence gathering in the early stages of the war. And the Union actually had sent more balloons up than the Confederates. The Confederates only managed to send up one balloon and get it operational. But interestingly, by the time of Gettysburg, the Union Army shut down the balloon service. It just seemed to be too much trouble for generals to cart all the equipment and the hydrogen gas producing machines you needed from one battlefield to another, so it never worked. George Sharp really was the first one who made effective use of all intelligence. He pioneered what CIA officers today call all-source intelligence. This was collecting information not only from his spies, but also from Confederate prisoner and deserter interrogations, from the information the balloons provided, from the telegraph lines, the interception of the signals there, and also cavalry scout reports that came in. And he was able to assemble all this information, collate it, synthesize it, analyze it, and present to the Union commanders the most effective intelligence reports that they ever had, far better than anything the South could produce. Basically, intelligence gathering is really a kind of a collection of a mosaic. There's little pieces everywhere. So there's never one eureka report from a spy that turns the tide of the war. Every time I see that in novels, I kind of wince because it just doesn't really happen in reality.
Right.
It's a matter of collecting small bits of information that finally put up together for you a coherent picture of the enemy in front of you.
In the few moments that we have left, in summation, you highlight these four people, Alan Pinkerton, Lafayette Baker, George Sharp, and as we've been talking about, Elizabeth Van Loo. You do mention others in the book. But at the end of the day, because there are some some criticisms levied against some of these four spies and others accolades. So in your estimation, especially as it resulted in finalizing the book, who stands out in your mind as the most effective? Was there one or a number of them more effective than the others?
Well, clearly George Sharp, who was Grant's spy master, and Elizabeth Van Loo were the most effective. They were the two heroes in this story. Alan Pinkerton turned out to be a failure as a military intelligence officer. He was a great detective, but a poor military intelligence officer. Lafayette Baker was a scoundrel. He put a lot of people in jail, a lot of them without, arrest warrants and without cause. He did break up some espionage and criminal rings, but he also pocketed a lot of the cash he confiscated, too. So it was kind of a good mix for me. I had two heroes, one failure, and one scoundrel.
Which is not unlike anything that goes on today, Doug, as I'm sure I'm sure you well know it, too. Do these people have any... do they resonate in the minds of security agencies today? Does the CIA, ICE, whatever it may be, who was ever protecting the American people, especially in terms of covertness? Do any of these people stand out as mentors or in other words, trailblazers?
Oh yes, as I say, they. A lot of what they did and the intelligence gathering in the Civil War set the template for what the CIA uses today and other spy agencies do. And it's interesting that you can go to the CIA website and there are declassified analytical reports that they've done on Union intelligence operations and Confederate intelligence operations for lessons learned, because they say a lot of the basics that they were doing back then during the Civil War are applied today, only with much higher tech, gadgets and gizmos.
See, I think that's fascinating that they're not shunning what was, those forebearers, the people that came before. They actually used that as, hey, look, this is where it all began. This is where, we got these ideas, and we've just, over the years, over the decades, we've modified it, and we've become much better at it. But because of these people, the Alan Pinkertons, the Bakers, the George Sharps, and the Elizabeth Van Loos of the world, certainly made a big difference. And I think it's great because the book highlights the fact that, as I said at the outset, and you even mentioned it, they're going back even further, which I didn't know, that as far back as the Revolutionary War, that this country, whatever military engagements we were involved in, that the covert operations and spying and the dissemination of vital information has made a big difference in the history and the future of this country. Doug, people want to get more information about your work, you personally. Is there a website? Is there an email or a way they can reach you directly?
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is Douglas C. Waller, WALLER.com. And that has information on Lincoln spies, interviews, videos, even an excerpt of the book, an audio excerpt of the book. Not only of Lincoln spies, but also my previous spies, too, spy books.
Yeah, and I'm sure that you would agree with me that this is very user friendly. I mean, it wasn't, some people think, well, gee, is that a book that only people who are who are into military strategy would understand? No, it's a very readable book. So anybody who's a history buff or wants to know more, especially about the Civil War, the between the Union and the Confederate armies, this is a great read. It really, as Doug has said, it was really the building blocks of what our intelligence community is today, and a number of the people that were so prominent in developing that. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, VUONA at WICN.org, or just go to our safe and secure website 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and get a gather of the multitude of broadcasting that we do here at WICN. For the public eye, this is Alvona.